Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Kay Dre, a board member of Beyond Nuclear, a non-profit organisation based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Initially, she was an activist in the civil rights field, and Kay has been studying, speaking and writing about the hazards of nuclear power and radioactive waste since 1974. She's particularly concerned about the radioactive waste, water and gases that are released from every single nuclear power plant during its operation and the, quotes, permissible levels of radiation to which workers at nuclear power plants and uranium fuel facilities are exposed. In 1976, she chaired a statewide petition drive and vote campaign that successfully outlawed charging Missouri electric ratepayers for the construction costs of a power plant until that plant becomes, quotes, operational and used for service. That law is still in place. Kay Dre joins me now on the line from St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome, Kay, to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
Now, Kay, you first came on my radar, I guess, some years ago, although I knew of you before, of course, when you were talking about routine emissions from nuclear power plants. And this has been one of your causes for a long time. Now, I don't know if anyone listening to this program understands that nuclear power plants are not benign objects sitting there in the middle of societies and communities and next to big cities, but in fact, they are routinely, which I think is a euphemism, releasing radioactive materials into the air. So I now give you the floor, Kay. I want to hear what they're emitting, how much they emit, and what it means. So start talking, and then I'll interrupt you with various questions.
Okay. It is true that nuclear power plants release radioactive gases and radioactivity into the discharge water. And a lot of some of the materials cannot technologically be filtered, and therefore they're not required to be. There is no economically feasible way to filter, for instance, radioactive hydrogen, which is called tritium. And so therefore they're not required to filter it. And there are some noble gases also and the tritium and the noble gases are released to whatever cooling water source, river, lake, or ocean that is needed to run the power plant. And the same materials are released to the atmosphere. So even if there are filters for the releases of gases and water, they don't filter some of the materials like tritium and noble gases that can become materials that we've been hearing about from Fukushima. They decay into materials like cesium-137. And so it was very surprising to me when I first found out that there's a hole in the reactor building, in the reactor containment building. There's a vent for releasing radioactive gases, for instance. They have to do this, otherwise the building maybe would explode someday or crack or something. So they vent or purge some of the radioactive gases. Also, if they kept building up inside the reactor building, for instance, and some of the other buildings, then workers would not be able to go in and make repairs to leaking pipes and so forth because the radiation level would be far too high.
Okay, so I want you to walk us through what are noble gases. I mean, when you say noble, I think of the Nobel Peace Prize, but what are noble gases? Let's do them first. And what do they decay to? And what are their half-lives?
Okay, well, there are xenon and krypton are two of the noble gases that I read about most from the in nuclear power plants. And when I first learned about the phrase noble gases, it was explained to me they don't mingle with the hoi polloi. They don't really combine with things. So they're sort of, they do break down into other isotopes. In the case of xenon, it when it gives off when a xenon atom, which xenon is a noble gas, when a xenon atom gives off a beta particle, that atom then becomes cesium. And so I think that some of the cesium-137 that we've been hearing about, that is so there's so much of it being released from the Fukushima reactors, maybe some of that is material that originally came out as xenon gas and decayed into cesium-137. And the same is true with krypton, which is another noble gas, and it cannot be filtered from the gases that are released to the atmosphere and the waters that are released to the river, lake, or ocean that they need for cooling. And so the krypton decays into rubidium, and then the rubidium decays into strontium. And when we were, when many of us were protesting the atmospheric bomb tests, the nuclear weapons tests, there were three isotopes that were mentioned most frequently that were of concern because they would fall out. The bombs would explode, and then these would end up, you know, in our drinking water, in our land, and cows would eat the grass and end up with strontium-90, which is a daughter of krypton, and cesium-137 was another one of the isotopes that was mentioned a great deal, and iodine-131. So there are filters for the gases that are released from the various buildings at nuclear power plants, but the filters cannot filter some things like tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, and they don't filter the noble gases.
Now, you didn't mention argon. That's a third noble gas. What about
argon? Right. I don't read much about argon. That's another noble gas, but I don't see it mentioned very much when they talk about the releases from nuclear power plants. I really should find out more about that.
Yes.
I just mostly read about xenon and krypton as noble gas, but also radon is another noble gas, and it's a daughter of uranium.
And so that's released, too, from nuclear power plants?
Yeah, right. And so...
Nasty one. That's very carcinogenic.
Right. I think they all may be, is what I think.
They are,
Because, you know, any exposure to radiation increases a person's risk.
Yes. Into that in a minute. I just want to go back to argon, krypton, and xenon, these noble gases that are routinely released all the time. I know that, Kay, they are high-energy gamma emitters, and gamma radiation is non-particulate. It's a sort of wave that goes straight through your body like an X-ray. And so if you're exposed to a cloud of radioactive gases like argon, krypton, and xenon, the gamma radiation will be going through your body like having an X-ray all the time. You don't become radioactive, but the genes can be damaged in the instant that you're exposed. But there's something else I'd like to just say from a medical perspective, if that's okay.
Sure.
I used to do, in medicine, I treated children with cystic fibrosis. And when I was at Harvard, we used to do what is called ventilation perfusion scans. In other words, getting children to inhale radioactive xenon and seeing which areas of the lung are still being aerated and other areas which were so clogged up with pus and abscesses and the like that they were not functional. And it was a good isotope to use in medicine because you could look at the X-ray picture and see where the xenon was in the lung, because it had emitted gamma radiation, which would expose the photographic film. But also, although xenon doesn't combine biochemically in the body with other chemicals, it is readily absorbed through the lung, through the air sacs, through the alveoli, into the bloodstream. And in fact, I've read recent medical literature, Kay, that xenon is very fat soluble and it tends to deposit in the fatty tissues of the body. And so in medicine, we are using it to delineate maybe tumours made of fat and the like, but it goes to the fatty tissues of the body, which are mostly located in the abdominal fat pad and in the upper thighs, and that's where the gonads are located, of course, testicles and ovaries. And because it emits very high energy gamma radiation like X-rays continually, and the xenon stays in the fatty tissue, I don't know how long, but for quite a while, therefore, if people are exposed to xenon and krypton and argon too, I'm sure, their testicles and ovaries will be being irradiated. Would you like to talk, Kay Dre, about what impact that could have medically if people's sperm and eggs and genes in the sperms and eggs are irradiated?
Well, you can end up, of course, affecting many future generations, and that's what's very disturbing. That can cause, you know, these mutations and so on can be inherited by future generations. And you know that although noble gases may not interact chemically with other materials, they can physically interact, so they can cause physical harm, you know, as you say, to the testicles and ovaries, or can penetrate body tissues and give off a lot of physical energy. And it can change the structure of DNA, like when a car is standing still and it's hit by a car in motion. And if the particle mutates a gene that produces an enzyme that is not particularly vital to the cell's machinery, the damage may not be noticeable. But if it mutates a gene important to cell function, various serious manifestations can occur, cancer and other life-shortening diseases. In, you know, and people talk about cancer all the time, but there can be diseases of the circulatory system, the respiratory system, and as you're mentioning, the reproductive system, the immune system. And so these, you know, are very, they're very damaging to the human body. And some of them are long-lived, and their daughter products can be very long-lived. And so it is just, you know, I think sometimes we had a lot of concerns about dioxin here in St. Louis, Missouri. And I wonder what people would say if they thought that a factory was intentionally releasing dioxin into the drinking water. Our nuclear power plant uses Missouri River water for cooling, and then that water becomes contaminated to a certain extent. Some of the materials are filtered out, but they're not all, like xenon and krypton, and those become entrained and travel in the water. And I wonder if people, you know, were told that a factory was releasing dioxin into their drinking water, I think they would have a fit. But they don't know about these routine releases of radioactive materials.
So xenon and krypton and argon, are they dissolved in the water? I knew that they were released into the air all the time, but I didn't know that they were also dissolved in the cooling water that's tipped into the Missouri River or into the adjacent lake. Are they?
Right. They are. The phrase that the nuclear industry uses and other people use, they say dissolved and entrained. And I remember learning about that from a wonderful physicist at Washington University here. I would take documents over to his house every Thursday,
yes,
and he would explain them to me, a wonderful man who died half a year ago, wonderful guy named Dan Bolas. And he would use the phrase dissolved and entrained noble gases. And I knew what dissolved meant, but I didn't know what entrained meant. It's a phrase the nuclear industry uses. And it just means moving along, you know. So
moving along
in the water. But it does, these materials, including my favorite isotope, which is really my...
We'll get into tritium in a minute.
It's on my license plate. And, you know, it's really bad.
Yes, well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
But they are released. They cannot be filtered. There's no economically feasible way to filter these noble gases.
But you know what, Kay? I was talking about, you know, all nuclear power plants use cooling water, 1 million gallons a minute, and there's a primary and secondary coolant loop. So the water comes in from the sea or from the lake or from the river, and it cools... The primary coolant, in other words, the primary coolant is the water that cools the actual radioactive core in the reactor. And then that is circulated adjacent to the secondary coolant system, and the two do not mix. But the secondary coolant system from the river, lake, or ocean cools the primary coolant. But I was told that by certain people who I shall not mention on the show at the moment that, in fact, many nuclear power plants do not release any radioactive materials into the secondary coolant and back into the ocean or river or lake because they've fixed that problem. Is that not so? Tell me, Kay.
They have not fixed that problem. And the San Onofre plant in California, it's called the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station, which is the acronym. The acronym is SONGS, S-O-N-G-S, which just makes me furious. But the San Onofre plant has just had tremendous problems with its steam generator because the steam generators in my plant here in Missouri, there are four steam generators, and there are thousands of tubes. And some of those tubes, there's tremendous pressure everywhere. And some of those steam generator tubes, they go through a series of metal plates with holes in them to keep them from banging into one another. But those plates have holes in them, and the holes sometimes make dents and impact upon the steam generator tubes. Inside the steam generator tubes is the water that's been in the reactor vessel. In other words, the water that gets really hot in the reactor vessel.
Radioactively
and thermally hot, It is inside the reactor vessel where there may be 50,000 fuel rods, some of which leak, and we can talk about why the reactor vessel water itself gets highly radioactive. But so the reactor vessel water, where the fuel rods, the uranium fuel rods are, that water gets hot, and it goes into tubes in the steam generator and then back into the reactor vessel. Well, people like to talk about that as a closed loop, but it isn't closed because some of those steam generator tubes leak, and so then this primary cooling water, the reactor vessel water, gets into the steam generator, and it can be released as gases or liquids into the environment. It leaks onto the ground, onto the floor, and so forth.
Is that true for every reactor design, Kay?
I cannot imagine that anyone would say I think we have, I'd have to look it up, you know, tens of thousands of steam generator tubes, and there are problems, and they have to plug some of the steam generator tubes when they find there's leakage. And the steam generators are extremely radioactively hot because they have this primary cooling water inside the tubes.
Yeah.
And there is leakage and so forth. And every nuclear power plant does release radioactive gases to the atmosphere and also into the river
Into the water.
So it's because the steam generators themselves are not perfect, and they have changed the kind of metal they've used to make the steam generator tubes, and they still are having problems. The San Onofre steam generators, San Onofre in California, shut down now because of so much leakage of the steam generators. And when workers go to repair or plug or whatever the defective steam generator tubes, the workers get tremendously high exposures to radiation because everything around the steam generators is so radioactively hot. And with gamma radiation that penetrates through the steam generators and you know, and the piping involved, it's just a very dangerous place for people to work. And I used to think maybe they were wearing lead-lined
underpants
or something. They don't. They have, you know, Tyvek and nylon and so forth.
Yeah, it makes no difference to the radiation at all. Now, so let's walk through a particular element. Let's talk about xenon K that decays to cesium-137, 134, whatever. And say it gets entrained or dissolved in the water that goes back into the lake or the river, okay, or the ocean. So the xenon decays to cesium. How long does the cesium last in the water, A, and B, talk about the food chains. What happens to the cesium once it gets into the river, lake, or sea? How does it get into our food and bioconcentration? Talk about that, Kay.
Well, that is extremely important. And, you know, any of these radioactive materials that are released into the river or into the air, and then they can come down as rain, snow, if they're in the river and microorganisms or small plants may take them into the, you know, and then little fish will eat the plants and the water will affect the small fish and then bigger fish eat those and so forth. And that's why they talk about bioconcentration, that it, as it goes up the food chain, there's a greater impact. And so it can't be filtered. And I remember, you know, when I first learned about these routine releases, I was reading about a reactor in New England, northeastern United States, and they said they found a lot of radioactive materials, not just cesium, but also cobalt-60, which is formed in the nuclear power plants. The rust all piping rusts eventually, and including nuclear power plants, they have rust, and it's called CRUD, C-R-U-D, and it stands for a reactor in Canada called Chalk River. It was Chalk River Unidentified Deposits. It's called CRUD. It was the first technical word I learned when I started fighting nuclear power in 1974. And so these radioactive materials give off cobalt-60, among other things, this radioactive rust, and also the radioactive rust can make the pipes less efficient and so forth. So they have workers, welders, and so forth when there are leaking pipes inside the reactor building or elsewhere in the power plant. Workers have to go next to those pipes and repair them, and they get major doses of gamma radiation from cobalt-60, which is the dominant isotope in radioactive rust. And so when I was reading about the releases from a plant in New England, and I read that there was a lot of cobalt-60 found right where the pipe that discharged the cooling water, they take in water from the ocean, let's say, or from the river, and they clean it up to a certain extent and then use it inside the reactor vessel and in the case of a pressurized water reactor in the steam generator tubes, and then it goes back into the reactor vessel. And they have to bleed off some of that every day because otherwise the reactor vessel water would get far too hot. So it turned out that they found a lot of cobalt-60 and other fission products and activation products in the mud, where the discharge water went back into the ocean in New England. They found it absorbed by the mud there. So they found that, yes, there's a lot of stuff that gets out, not just noble gases and that turn into solid daughter products like cesium and krypton. I mean, like cesium and strontium. But some of the materials that shouldn't have gotten out at all also do get out. And so all this stuff is accessible to ocean creatures or fish. And I think people don't know about that. They do not know that these materials get out of the nuclear power plants. And I remember when I first learned about the fact that some of these materials are released to the environment, I knew that they, when they were starting to build the Callaway nuclear plant here in Missouri, I knew that the walls were going to be very thick with having lots of steel bars in them, rods, you know, to make them thick and strong and so forth. But so I thought it would take a huge explosion for these walls to crack or so on. But what I found out is that there are vents in these buildings, and there are some even that are used all the time, very small vents, but they do what they call purge the inside air that's in a building, and it goes up into the atmosphere, and that air can be very radioactively hot. And even though there, again, are filters, the filters don't capture all of it. So they release some of it just directly out of these vents that are in various buildings. And where the steam generators are, that steam goes out. That steam becomes very radioactive, and it goes out into the environment also. So can rain down. And so there is bioconcentration among a lot of creatures who in the ocean or river, but in addition on the ground.
Well, also, what about, people need to know that when cesium, when you eat a fish with cesium in it, or you eat some meat with cesium in it, because it's been concentrated up in the food chain by orders of magnitude at each step. The cesium is a potassium analog, but the body thinks it's potassium, and all our cells in the body are very rich in potassium, and so it concentrates in many organs of the body. For instance, well, we're now finding out there's a wonderful man called Bandachevsky, who is a Russian who has spent years and years looking at cesium concentration in various organs, and it actually concentrates in heart muscle and in the endocrine organs. And we're seeing now, and we saw post-Chernobyl, a lot of people developing heart disease, myocardial disease, because the muscle of the heart has been impacted by very radioactive cesium, and people are developing diabetes and the like. But cesium actually also causes brain tumors, very rare muscle tumors called rhabdomyosarcomas, testicular and ovarian cancers, but also has a very big impact upon heart muscle and upon endocrine glands. Do you know about Bandachevsky's work, Kadre?
I have heard recently, yes.
Yeah, he's this Russian who looked at many hundreds of autopsies of people exposed to the radiation from Chernobyl, and found that the heart muscle in particular and the endocrine organs concentrate cesium very highly. And his work was published in Russian, and then the Russians didn't like what he was doing. He got jailed for about 5 years. He was put in jail for his work, okay?
Wow.
And then he was released a while ago, and he's now, I think, working in Paris. His work is very significant because they're now reporting, Kay, people who are dropping dead from heart disease post-Fukushima. And the work hasn't been done yet to see if their heart muscle is full of cesium-137, but people are postulating that that is so. So there are so many ramifications of nuclear power, aren't there, Kay?
Right, and when you mentioned cesium-137, which, as I said, was there when they were doing atmospheric bomb testing when my kids were little, and we sent in their baby teeth, and they studied how much strontium-90 were in the teeth.
Yes,
from fallout from the nuclear weapons, atmospheric nuclear weapons testing, and you know the thing that happens with something like strontium-90 or cesium-137, they have a half-life of 30 years, and you have to multiply the half-life by at least 10 to know how long that isotope, that material will continue giving off beta particles, gamma rays, whatever. And so it's something that's, you know, it's not just right when there is an accident, you know, but it persists in nature, and it's very disturbing. And you know, and they keep finding out about other, you know, we've known that cesium and strontium were dangerous, because in the case of strontium, it can get on into grass where cows eat, and then people, children particularly, are of concern. They drink the milk, and they're ingesting strontium 90 or strontium 89. But you know, they keep finding that additional radioactive materials are particularly dangerous, like cerium, which sounds like cesium, but it's C-E-R-I-U-M, and so forth. They find out that a lot of these radioactive materials are particularly harmful for living creatures.
Well, what I know, there are 200 elements made when you fission uranium in a nuclear power plant, but Kay, many of them have not been studied from a biological perspective. Do you know anything about cerium? Where does it go in the body? How does it concentrate? What does it actually
do? I'm not certain, but I know that the National Commission on Radiological Protection did a whole report on cerium, and I have it here. I'm 79 years old, and I don't remember things as well as I wish I did.
Oh.
But if anyone, you know, they could look up National Council on Radiological Protection, NCRP,
yes,
and find out a report on cerium.
Oh,
and
I'm going to
outline those things. And yet, a lot of the people who prepare these kinds of reports are not anxious to tell the public how dangerous things radioactive are. I worked with a bunch of atomic veterans, men, United States citizens, you know, who were exposed to atom bomb tests.
Yes.
And I took notes from 40 of them. I went to a conference in Washington a long time ago. And some of those men were very concerned about, you know, they didn't want me to keep their names, which I did not, you know, if they didn't want me to. But they did tell me about how they were having all kinds of problems, not just cancer, but also muscular problems and heart problems and so forth. And some of them said they couldn't find any medical doctors willing to speak up on their behalf to try to get compensation. And although they do help what they call atomic veterans now in our country, they have to be able to prove that their cancer or whatever, a certain kind of cancer, was caused by their exposure to atom bomb tests. And we also are compensating people who worked at uranium facilities, which we had, for instance, here in St. Louis. We had some facilities. We have what I call the oldest radioactive waste of the atomic age here in St. Louis, Missouri, because we purified, we meaning a company downtown near downtown St. Louis, purified all the uranium that went into the world's first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction on December 2nd, 1942. And they processed uranium here in St. Louis for 25 years, and we have radioactive waste all over the place that was spilled or blown or whatever during that 25-year period. And they've cleaned up some of the sites, but not all of them. But workers who worked at those factories are being compensated if they can prove they worked there and if they have certain cancers and so forth. So, you know, but it was very hard when I interviewed these 40 atomic veterans, men who had been exposed to the atom bomb tests in the 50s, I guess, early 60s, they couldn't get any doctors to help them. So I spoke at a meeting of physicians for social responsibility, and I said, if there is any doctor here who can help some of these atomic veterans, would you please let me know? And not one came up to offer to help.
Because
a lot of doctors, and I don't mean to say disparaging things about your profession, but a lot of doctors use radiation, of course, to find out what's wrong with a patient and so forth, and they don't want to admit that radiation can be harmful.
Oh, listen, it's true. We are almost the biggest irradiators of the population at the moment. Well, I'm not sure about that when I think about the nuclear industry too. But you know, if you've got pneumonia, you need an X-ray because the risk is minimal, although there is a risk of getting cancer from X-rays. But the benefit is great to get your pneumonia diagnosed and treated. On the other hand, we use X-rays injudiciously. For instance, CT scans give you whopping doses, very high doses. And people just go in and have whole body scans and say, well, I haven't got cancer. But they've been exposed to high levels of radiation, which could induce later on cancer in those individuals. A report's just come out from the radiological community, the radiologists, to say that people who have a lot of dental X-rays have a high incidence of brain cancer. You shouldn't get your teeth X-rayed every year, for instance. So although we use X-rays, if we're a good doctor, we use them judiciously. That doesn't negate the fact that we should step in and help those atomic veterans because, of course, they've been exposed to high doses of radiation. I think that we're not taught enough about radiation and nuclear power and medical and isotopes in medical school to really understand the significance, Kay, of what we're talking about today.
Right. And people, you know, I say, well, people who are nuclear engineers don't want to get rid of nuclear engines. And health physicists who work with radiation, you know, that's what they learn about. They learn about the hazards of radiation. And some of them don't like to talk about those hazards. But they certainly do exist. And I think more of the public is learning about that. But you haven't let me talk about tritium.
I'm going to. I just want to reintroduce you again. I'm speaking with Kay Dre, who's a board member of Beyond Nuclear and has been deeply concerned about all things nuclear, but particularly nuclear power plants for years. So, Kay, I want you to talk about tritium, your favorite isotope.
Well, when I first learned about tritium, I noticed I was reading a document that was prepared by our electric utility because they wanted to build our first nuclear reactor here. Actually, they wanted to build two reactors, and they still do. But in the document, the environmental impact statement, I noticed that they claimed that very small amounts of lots of different radioisotopes would be released into the Missouri River and into the air, and they, you know, were tiny amounts. But I noticed that there were something like 410 curies, which is how they measure radioactivity, that 410 curies per year of H3 would be released, and I was told that's tritium hydrogen and radioactive hydrogen. And so I thought I wanted to find out what is tritium. So I picked up the phone and called a health physicist at a national laboratory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And I said, could you please, I'm concerned about tritium. I see that a lot will be released into the air and into the water, into the Missouri River from a nuclear power plant that they want to build in Missouri. And I said, can you please tell me about tritium? And the health physicist said, tritium is no big deal. All it can do is destroy a DNA molecule.
Oh, my God.
And so I said, you know, I really don't want my DNA molecules destroyed or my children's DNA molecules destroyed, my husband and other people. And at any rate, so I began reading about tritium, and I have a whole filing drawer of reports about tritium and the health hazards of tritium. It is radioactive hydrogen, which is a part of water, can be a part of water, and it does cause health effects. And it should not be, you know, I think that alone is reason not to have nuclear power plants, because the water itself in the reactor becomes, the hydrogen in the water becomes radioactive. And so, at any rate, that, you know, that is very disturbing. And I do have lots of medical reports about the hazards of tritium, and people can find that on the computer. They can read about it.
All right, but now I want you to talk about tritium. You haven't told us. What is it? What are the medical hazards? How long does it last? I want you to walk us through the whole thing.
Well, tritium has a half-life of 12 years, roughly, and you have to multiply the half-life by at least 10. It's not two half-lives and then it stops giving off radiation, but it has a half-life of 12 years, And so it means that the tritium that's being created right now in a nuclear power plant near all of us, that tritium will be around for at least 120 years, probably, that isotope, that atom of tritium or whatever, the tritiated water and gases. And so it cannot be filtered. There's no way, no economically feasible way to filter it from the releases into the air, into the water, and therefore they're not required to filter it. And as with noble gases, they really don't know how much is released. And it is something that has become a part of our environment.
Yeah, but describe what a half-life is. I don't think people know.
Right. I thought two half-lives, and a half-life is the way they describe how long it takes an isotope to give off its radioactivity. So tritium has a half-life of about 12.3 years, which means that if you have a cupful of tritium today, in 12 years, you'll have half of the atoms in that cupful of tritium will have given off their beta particle and gone off and zapped something. And you'll have a half of amount of tritium that will still be radioactive. And in another 12 years, you'll have half of that, and in another 12 years. So you have to figure at least 10 half-lives. When I first learned about the term half-life, I thought two half-lives, and then that would be over.
Yes.
But when I learned that it about half-lives, I learned that you have to multiply the half-life by at least 20 to find out how long a particular material will continue giving off, in the case of tritium, beta radiation particles, or some give off beta and gamma, and some give off alpha particles and so forth. But you have to multiply. Now I hear, you know, people say we have to multiply the half-life by 10. But when I first learned about it, I was told by 20. So you have to learn what the half-life is, and then multiply it by at least 10 to find out how long, let's say, a handful of cesium-137 will continue giving off its beta particles and gamma rays.
So tritium, its half-life is 12.3 years. So if you multiply that by 10, that's 123 years, or double that if you multiply it by 20. And tritium, yes, it's very scary because it combines in the water molecule to form H3O, so you have radioactive water. And the other thing that I learnt, Kay, which I didn't know about, but as it's continually released into the air and water from every nuclear power plant in large amounts every day, if you live near a reactor and there's an inversion system and there's a fog, the fog is tritiated water, composed of tritiated water from the reactor. And tritium, unlike most other nasty things, actually penetrates through the skin, passes through the skin. Now, the skin is the most important organ in the body. You know, if you get burnt 50% or more, then you'll probably die because the skin protects you from everything. But tritium gets through the skin. And it's also absorbed through the lung, and it concentrates, bioconcentrates in food that you eat. And it is a nasty, nasty radioactive element because it only gives off a beta particle, which is an electron. And it's a soft energy emitter. In other words, the electron doesn't have so much energy. It whizzes out through the skin. It stays and is absorbed in the tissues surrounding the beta particle, surrounding the tritium. Hence, it's extremely mutagenic and extremely carcinogenic and can cause cancer in every organ of the body and also produce congenital abnormalities. And I'll just finish this little speech in a minute, but the Germans and the French have just studied children under the age of 5 living within a couple of miles of nuclear reactors, little children, who are very, very sensitive to radiation, and find that the incidence of leukemia is more than double in those children, and the incidence of solid cancers is high. And I would suggest, and I want you to comment on this, Kay, that almost certainly tritium releases, which are continuous and routine, are responsible for much of that malignancy that we're now seeing, along with other isotopes. Would you like to talk about that, Kay?
Well, I really think that's true, that, you know, the tritium and other radioactive gases and so forth, they are releasing these. They cannot have nuclear power without releasing tritium because there is no economically feasible way to remove it. People have tritium in their watches, and so sometimes people will say, well, how did they get the tritium if they can't economically filter it out? Well, they can get the amount of tritium they need in a laboratory for making a wristwatch or something. But the amount, at the Callaway plant in Missouri, they take in 20,000 gallons a minute and release back into the river 5,000 gallons a minute. And they can't even monitor what's in that 5,000 gallons per minute that's going back into the river. So there is tritium and other things that they, you know, and the noble gases and other things that get out that they don't even know how much is being released. They release tritium also into the atmosphere and then it comes down as rain and snow.
Yeah.
They just cannot monitor it. They don't know, but they, you know, and for a while they were discovering that there were a lot of reports that there were underground pipes that would go, you know, from the nuclear power plant, and they had a lot of reports about leaks of these pipes. The pipes were leaking, and they were leaking tritium, for instance. And that was, you know, so there was so much leakage that they couldn't deny it because they found it, you know, right where the pipes were leaking. But the pipes that were leaking were taking the discharge water from the reactor vessel initially, you know, and then it would go maybe through steam generators and back into the vessel and so forth. And some of it is, they call it, they shim bleed, S-H-I-M, they shim bleed some of that water intentionally out of the reactor vessel so that it, where the fuel rods are, so that it doesn't get hotter and hotter and hotter, you know, radioactively hotter, and then workers wouldn't be able to make repairs to pipes and so forth. So at any rate, the water that they were releasing back into the river, lake, or ocean, that was, some of the pipes leaked. Well, if they hadn't leaked into the groundwater, that tritiated water and radioactively contaminated water would have gone right into the lake and ocean, in a lake or ocean. And I think that's very important. In other words, there are not only leaks of tritiated water, but there are releases, in planned releases, permissible releases. The word permissible is very important. There are permissible levels of these radioactive materials that are allowed to be released into the air and water. But permissible does not mean safe.
Yeah, that's right. They use all these euphemisms, which is really getting my goat at the moment. I have to tell you, Kay, tritium, I learned about it because my son was in California with his new wife, and they were near Berkeley. And there's a lab at Berkeley, a radiation lab, and I can't remember the name of it. But anyway, they were handling tritium. So I learned from my son several things. One, tritium cannot be contained in any container. It's such a tiny radioactive atom, and it's only hydrogen, and it gets out of stainless steel, glass, lead. The only thing that prevents its release is gold, because gold is so dense. So you can't stop release of tritium. You absolutely can't. And this lab at Berkeley was next to a museum of sort of past nuclear weapons designs and everything. And they used to take children and kindergarten students into the museum on tours. Well, the intake for the air conditioner was right next to the lab, which was continually emitting tritium. So the tritium was being piped into the museum where the kids were being taken on tours, number one. Number two, they measured the leaves of the trees near the lab, and the leaves were full of tritium, and at night the leaves would expire water, as trees do. They're always expiring water into the air. And the water was full of tritium, so the water would drop down onto the ground. So there was a continuous cycle of the trees sucking in tritium from the air and from the ground, and then expiring it at night and dropping again on the ground. And I remember my son being so concerned about this and about his beautiful new wife, you know, and their future, their reproductive future, really. And they moved soon. But when you look into these situations regarding tritium, Kay, it blows your mind, doesn't it?
Right, and there are many studies. They don't do studies supposedly on human beings, but there are studies on animals. I have many of them. I have abstracts if people, wanted to write to me or to. I'm a board member of Beyond Nuclear in based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And Beyond Nuclear could send some of the abstracts of some of the scientific articles. And I remember hearing about they found tritium in chocolate cake next from at a grade school. I think it was in Arizona.
Really?
And it wasn't just a fleeting thing, because the tritium, it has a half life of 12.3 years. But they used to say, they talk about a half life of an isotope. But they also talk about a biological half-life, how long it supposedly stays in a human body before it is emitted. And they used to say, and I think I still do read sometimes, where they claim that tritium has a biological half-life of 8 days, meaning it would be in your life, in your body, if you swallowed or if you drank or inhaled tritium, it would be in your body for 8 days times 10 or whatever. But it turns out that the workers who were working at a factory near the grade school where they found tritium in chocolate cake at this grade school, it turned out it was in the workers' bodies for several years, not just a matter of So this business of claiming that there's a limited biological half-life is just not accurate. But people aren't given much, scientists aren't given a lot of money to study the biological impacts of these materials. It's not something that the federal government wants to fund particularly.
But for all that, when I was asked to write an article about nuclear power for the New England Journal of Medicine, and I spent a year in the Countway Library at Harvard researching the literature, and I found that the best source I could find on radioactive elements made in reactors and what happens to them in our food chains and in our human bodies was the Journal of Health Physics, which Health Physics was founded by a wonderful man called Carl Z. Morgan, who has since died. And I found a huge literature, Kay, on tritium written, this is later actually, in the early 90s in the Journal of Health Physics. So it's not as if we don't know, and it's not as if they don't know. And I think what I've come to realize is that the nuclear industry is scared, very scared of tritium. But they will say to the public, don't worry, it's only radioactive hydrogen, as if don't worry about it. But, when I see people with radioactive watch dials, it's probably tritium. And as we know, tritium leaks and escapes from everything, and they have got a tritiated watch dial, and their tritium's probably getting in through their skin, and it's probably, if they get near the watch, they're probably inhaling the tritium. There are so many things that we need to teach people, don't we, Kay, that people don't understand. And there is a fair amount of literature on the medical effects of these isotopes, but in fact the scientists who do the work and the nuclear industry and the federal government are not teaching the people about these incredible dangers to which we're exposed.
And the fact that these materials are routinely released You know, it does not take an accident. And that is something, you know, we just do not hear. I mean, we're hearing about the horrendous tragedy in Japan with Fukushima reactors. And boy, is that not over. I mean, that's very, very frightening. Because, you know, we have these horrible spent fuel pools where they take the highly radioactive fuel rods that have been in the reactor vessel, and they have to replace those every once in a while with fresh fuel rods. And those are, you know, the ones that have been in the reactor are just so, so highly contaminated. And at one of the reactors at Fukushima in Japan, you know, this they're terrified about the spent fuel pool at reactor 4 because it could collapse, it could explode. It's just, the whole thing is just terrifying. And so we, you know, it is just, we have a pamphlet, Beyond Nuclear has a pamphlet called Dirty, Dangerous, and Expensive. And that is the problem. You know, we're not being given the facts. And in our pamphlet, we say nuclear power is based on false promises and real dangers. And it's expensive. Nuclear power is expensive. And it's dangerous, and we have no way to protect people when there's an accident. We don't have really any workable evacuation plans, and the longevity of these materials is just incredible. You know, they're going to be giving off extremely dangerous radiation particles and rays, some of them virtually forever. Uranium, the uranium they use for fuel in these reactors, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. That's with a B. And multiply, you know, that's the life of the planet Earth, and you have to multiply that by 10 to find out how long these particular, you know, this uranium will remain radioactive. This is forever.
Yeah, it's forever.
We have no place. We have no place in the United States to put the fuel rods, and we may never have a place.
Yeah. Well, look, on that note, Kay, we've reached the end of our time. There's so much more to talk about. We didn't even talk about worker exposure or permissible doses or any of that stuff. So I'm going to have to interview you again, Kay, in the future, maybe the near future, to talk about permissible doses. But thank you for a fascinating discussion, which I'm sure everyone was interested in. Kay, thank you for your lifetime dedication to this incredibly important issue.
Thank you so much for your leadership in this field.
Well, we all have to do our part, don't we? So thank you very much, and we'll be back in touch with you in the near future for the next episode. Okay. Bye-bye, Kay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
On If You Love This Planet Today, I've been speaking with Kay Dre, a board member of Beyond Nuclear, a non-profit organization based in Tacoma Park, Maryland, in the USA. Thanks for listening. I hope you found it an edifying discussion. We'll have another fascinating program for you next week. So bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.